I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Sally Bingham. She is an author. Her new book is The Blue Box, Three Lives in Letters. She will be speaking on Saturday, the 20th of September at 2 o'clock at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a book. It's called The Blue Box. And there is an actual, literal blue box from which these stories emerged. Tell us that story.
Well, when my mother died some years ago and my sister Eleanor was clearing out her house, she found a literal blue box. It's quite large, pale blue, on the top shelf of her clothes closet. Took it down, opened it, and saw masses of letters and papers, many of them tied up with strings, some with notes on them, that none of us had ever seen before. I don't think my mother had even looked at them. They were gathered together by a remote relative, Bernard Caperton, probably 50 years ago, who took an interest in family histories and felt that my mother would be the one to keep them. She kept them, but she never told us about them or did anything with them. So it was a treasure trove, undiscovered treasures, linking 1817, which is the oldest letter, with the 1930s.
And this is your mother, your grandmother, and your great-grandmother.
That's right.
And all of them, in different ways, writers, all of them very... Women of character,
yeah,
shall
women
we say.
Of great character. I say their uniting trait was a certain unyielding resiliency. And that is true. They were all very small women. They barely topped 5 feet. In late age, got quite plump. In early age, were very proud of their tiny waists and their tiny feet. They were all from Richmond, Virginia, and most people have a little idea what that means. So they were not well known, they had no money, they didn't achieve fame, but what they achieved was this extraordinary development of character. I've really never encountered anything like it, in the midst of a good deal of hardship.
It's interesting because in a box like this, it's kind of random. It's not that each of them intended to leave their history for one of their descendants to find. And so there's things that are there and there's things that aren't there. There's letters, but then other letters are missing.
Yes.
And you have to, as the person who finds them is trying to make sense of all of it, extrapolate, put things together, guess.
And also learn a lot about the context.
Yeah.
For instance, my great-grandmother, who was born in 1850, lived through the Civil War in Richmond, Virginia, which was the capital of the Confederacy. But in her view, the war was just a reason why you couldn't get new party dresses because of the blockade. And although her father turned their house into a military hospital, her view of these soldiers lying wounded in bed is that they were just having such a good time and resting there, and their mothers came to visit them, and she played with her dolls on their beds. There wasn't any amputation or death or disease, or it was all lovely and clean. And that's really a rather familiar view of the Civil War from conventional white people, because otherwise they would have to deal with issues that would be pretty uncomfortable for them.
Well, there is, I mean, that is the subtext, and you talk about it in the book, at the beginning of the book, is part of the identity of these women, at least on the early side, maybe all the way through, was the sense of their superiority as white people over black people.
Yes, and over other white people, too. This is something William Faulkner writes about a good deal, too. This whiteness is not based on money or education. It's based simply on the facts of what family you were born into. And, of course, there can't be any whiteness without blackness. And, therefore, it was very important for all three women, even spanning this enormous amount of time, to enforce the idea that they ruled not by privilege, but by their merit. Now, if you had to say, well, what was their merit, it'd be a little hard to say, other than that they were white.
That they were white and that they were from these first families of Virginia.
Yes, from the first families of Virginia. And therefore, when my great-grandmother talks about the slave children that she was raised with, it's as though, well, we were all just happy little children running around together. And that's a very familiar view. Some people even accuse Uncle Tom's Cabin of that view, though that novel's much more complex. It's a very familiar view among conventional white people in the South.
There's a few photographs, very old photographs, of family members with the quote-unquote loyal slave.
Oh, yes.
And that myth of the happiness and loyalty of their slaves before the Civil War and their servants after.
Yes, absolutely essential. And then the shift that came after emancipation, this would be my grandmother's early life, was these black people were still working for them. Presumably they got paid a little something, probably not much. Of course, most of the able-bodied left, if they possibly could, but the ones that stayed tend to be the older, possibly sicker people who maybe felt they couldn't make it out of the South. So my grandmother's stories about these people who took care of them are full of a kind of grotesque humor, as though they're all broken puppets now. They've lost whatever dignity and power they maybe had, oddly enough, in slavery, because these are the remnants. These are the ones that are left. So she makes a lot of pretty incorrect jokes about old Uncle So-and-so who couldn't stand up straight, or somebody else who got drunk and fell down on the floor. They've become not only human, but in a different way, a little less than human. So it's an interesting transition, and I don't know whether that is true of all writing that spans 1850 to 1930. I don't know that that would be the case, but in this case, what replaced slavery was the remnants of slavery.
What was it like for you to read those accounts?
Well, what really helped is that they're so funny. They had, all three had marvelous sense of humor. I think it explains this resilience. Nothing could get them down, because almost anything that happened would be seen as being funny. For instance, my grandmother, who spent her summers in Ireland as a child, her father, who was dead, was Irish, was taken to what they called the poorhouse as part of her duties as a Christian girl. And her descriptions of some of the women that she saw in this poorhouse are just absolutely uproarious. So that made it easier. If it had been dead serious, dead on racism, it would have been a good deal more difficult, but it was gilded with this sense of humor.
In the beginning of the book, you write about what women add to the official history that is always written by men, of whatever the time and place is, and there's something in women's accounts that disturbs the official history.
It can.
Was there any of that in The Blue Box?
Yes, there was, but I had to wait till I came to my mother's life. When she had graduated from college and gone on a scholarship to the University of Athens, this would have been 1930, she started getting in a lot of trouble. Going out late, not attending classes, having a very serious boyfriend.
Having a boy in her room.
Having a boy in her room. And her attempts to cover that up were really the other side of the story. We all know these things happen. They always have happened. But her skill and her ruthlessness in proving that all these scandals were totally baseless, when obviously all kinds of things have been going on, that was a little crack in the armor. It showed me how willing she was, and probably her mother and grandmother too, to stretch the truth when it was to their advantage.
We're talking to Sally Bingham about her new book, The Blue Box. Now, all of them, your four mothers, mm-hmm. mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, had their love stories, their courtship stories. And it's interesting to read them because each one tells us a little bit about the context for love and marriage at that time, mm-hmm. and how it changed over the years.
Yes, indeed. Well, my great-grandmother and my grandmother had more limited possibilities. They never left Richmond, Virginia. They didn't go to college. So they basically had to choose from the available suitors, who were white men of their class and their age. And the only way my great-grandmother escaped that was that this handsome man from Northern Ireland came to Richmond looking for property, and she saw him driving horses in tandem down the street, which she'd never seen before. She was a great horsewoman. So she asked to be introduced to him, and in her telling, it was as though the next day they were married. It couldn't have been quite that quick, but it was pretty quick. In my grandmother's case, it was more, I think, that she was desperate to get away from home at 17, and the only person who showed up was my grandfather, Clifford Caperton, who turned out to be an alcoholic, and I think it was quite an unhappy marriage. So that was more about just sheer escape. Let me out of this family house where I'm living with three generations of my relatives. In my mother's case, because she won a scholarship to Radcliffe in 1928, which was called something like the Scholarship for Girls from Faraway Places. It was for young women from more than 60 miles outside of Boston. So coming from Richmond, she was a good deal further than that. By dint of hard work, she won the scholarship, went to Cambridge, was a very serious classic scholar. I think really imagined an academic career for herself. There are very few women in that field then, but she could have been one of the first. But then she saw a much more glamorous opportunity when she met my father, who was at Harvard. And so that opened a whole world to her that neither her mother nor her grandmother could really have imagined, including money and travel and diplomatic service and newspaper business. And she loved that. And I don't know what the price was. Probably there was a price that she paid for that. But she was very much on the order of those literary heroines who decide early, this is what I want and this is how I'm going to go about getting it.
Well, she also had a pretty long relationship with your father before they were married or even engaged.
Yes, they met in junior year in college. They were both in an undergraduate production called The Love of Three Oranges. And the story goes that my father was the prince and my mother was one of several girls in the show who stepped out of an orange. And when he saw her stepping out of this papier-mâché orange, he was very taken. Well, he may have been very taken, but she had to chase him strenuously for 4 years. And a lot of the letters between them are recording her efforts to get him to come to terms, and he wasn't in the least bit interested in that. He was having far too good a time. Young, handsome, rich, the world at his feet. And she was really having a difficult time after she graduated. She had thought he would propose to her, but he didn't. So she got a job at Little Brown in Boston and worked there, and he would come up from Kentucky from time to time, as she said, with a trunk full of bourbon, and disrupt everything and create a carnival. And finally she decided she couldn't deal with it anymore after 4 years, so she abruptly left Boston and went to Paris to live with a friend of hers. And my father was horrified. He never expected this. That didn't do it, however. What finally provoked the proposal, and this was one of the most interesting letters of all the letters, he had had a very close friend at Harvard, very close friend. We don't need to examine exactly what that meant. And this close friend got into a car wreck on the way back from the Yale-Harvard game and was killed. And the same letter in which my father announced to my mother in Paris that this young man had died was the letter in which he sort of proposed to her.
Right.
It still wasn't very certain. She still had to go through about 6 months of dickering, because I don't know that he ever really wanted to be married. He had a lot of other things he wanted to do. But anyway, they did finally get married that June.
The three generations, and it really does span a long time. I mean, the first one having been born in 1850 and going up to here you are sitting in the Santa Fe Baking Company and
yes,
we're talking about them. They, in a way, kind of paint a picture of the trajectory of women and of Southern women well over a century, century and a half. And there seem to be different dimensions to that. I mean, one of them is early on women were taught and really enforced not to question. By the time it gets to you, you're questioning everything.
Yes.
There's a deep divide between the North and the South. I mean, your great-grandmother talks about Northerners as the scum of the earth, and then your mother goes north to college. I mean, there's a lot of movement. And I was wondering how you, here you are, the recipient of this movement, how you experience that.
Well, it definitely has propelled me, which is interesting because my mother did not like the fact that I was being propelled out of the South as she was out of the South to Radcliffe as she went to Radcliffe. It made her actually quite uneasy because I think as she grew older, she became a good deal more conservative and thought that the old way was maybe the better way. But there is that sense of motion. And I think any three generations of a woman's family, you would find that sense of motion, except when the outward circumstances are so hopeless. You know, there's so much poverty, it's so hard just to survive. But if there's enough to survive, and if women begin to be educated, which of course was happening in my mother's generation and has continued, then some options begin to open. And more than that, there has to be a real examination of that old icon, the angel in the house. That was that Victorian idea of a woman's role, which I think is still has some feeling around it, as though, well, maybe that is the beautiful woman, you know, the woman who sacrifices herself for her family and her children and so on. I think we have to examine all that with great care because women will never move along as long as we're hampered by this ideology of the home and the children and the cooking and all of that.
And we don't really have a functional alternative model.
No,
at
we
this
don't.
Point. Everybody's making it up and putting it together, and it's not working very smoothly for everybody.
No, it's not. And I think one thing that makes that difficult is that the women who have moved forward tend to be pretty forceful. And a lot of us are not very attracted by that. We want to be liked. We want to be loved. And when we look, for instance, at the women who organized and ran the suffrage movement, those are some tough women.
Those are women who were tortured, beaten
absolutely,
up, killed, and so
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I think there's a sort of flinching away from the kind of assertiveness that probably, it may be that men take more for granted, that if you're going to do anything or get anywhere, you're going to have to be fairly assertive or you'll get stopped in your tracks. And I think that's a tough thing for women. I really do. I feel it in myself, and I see it in almost all the women I know, that if it comes to a choice between being liked and getting something done, we'll probably choose being liked.
Very interesting. And that is something, when you put it that way, that then is a topic of conversation that young women can have over dinner.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was struck when I was reading your book by, I mean, these are people who, as you say, are not well known to history. They're
no.
your family.
Yes.
And you are the product of this family. And the experience of going through the box and relating not only to these letters, but objects, like there's a little paragraph about pin cushions.
Mm-hmm.
And these, somehow, little objects like that hold so much history and resonance and meaning, at least for someone in the family. And I was wondering what that was like for you.
Oh, it was amazing. It made them, I'd heard these names all through my growing up, but I didn't know any of the stories. And for instance, when I found these two green silk pin cushions, which were beaded by the Irish nurse who raised my great-grandfather, suddenly this woman, Curdy, about whom I still know almost nothing, was absolutely real because her hands, it's actually not beads, it's straight pins, had set these straight pins into this green silk to spell out his name and his birth date. And I think objects, in a way, carry more weight for us even than words. I had just received something that made my mother vivid to me, which was a round pink hat box, and in it was a very, from our eyes, odd-looking feathered hat with a little note on it in her handwriting saying, "Hat given to me by Barry," that's my father, "after the liberation of Paris." Well, she kept it all those years because that moment when people in the U.S. realized that the Nazis were out of Paris was so historic, and yet the way to commemorate it for a woman was a hat.
Right. You, at a certain point, had a break with your mother.
Yes.
And during the end of her life, you were no longer close. Now you were close to her again through this. It must have been kind of weird and poignant.
Yes, and I had to realize that she probably would hate for me to read, particularly her letters about this so-called scandal in Greece. She would never have wanted me to know that. But, you know, it's so paradoxical. Even though she didn't speak to me for the last 10 years of her life, I knew why she didn't, and she warned me that she wouldn't. So it was very much a part of her highly principled character, unbending, which for which I have some admiration. It wasn't under the table. It wasn't something I didn't expect. She really gave me an opportunity to choose. If you write this book, I will never speak to you again. Not this book, but a book I wrote 25 years ago. And I knew it was a serious issue. I knew she would follow through. And I had a weird kind of respect for the fact that she would lay her cards on the table. I don't think she particularly wanted to be completely cut off from her oldest daughter. But for her, principle was all. And if you have to cut off your hand for principle, you cut off your hand. So it's actually been a fairly smooth resolution for me, because she was doing what she had always done, which is to put principle, as she saw it, above anything else. And I knew that about her. I knew that about her. And I think in some secret way, I probably knew since I was a child that at some point I would run up against this.
Do you have a box or anything that you are going to leave to your children, grandchildren?
No, what I've done is to start an archive at Duke University called the Sally Bingham Archive for Women's Letters and Papers. Started first as a place for my letters and papers, and then because I'm convinced that we all have a place in history. And now it's much expanded after 25 years and has become one of the three big archives collecting women's papers. So that's where my things are.
Sally Bingham's new book is called The Blue Box, Three Lives in Letters, and she will be speaking next weekend, Saturday, September 20th, at 2 o'clock at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. The book was just published yesterday. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. This was terrific.